Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free.
Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
There's Mr. Aaron West. I am Mark Herney here for Criterion Close Up number 64, Aaron. Sometimes it's hard to keep track of the numbers, I think, since we kind of rebooted this thing. But I think it's 64, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great to talk to you again, Aaron. And we have a special guest today getting into a little bit of Hal Ashby and her directorial debut, as I understand, the documentary Hal.
Feature debut, right?
Feature debut. Yeah,
yes.
That's right. Amy Scott, welcome to Criterion Close Up.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here.
Good to have you.
Thanks.
I guess you did mention she directed Hal. It came out a couple months ago from Oscilloscope. Is that right, Amy?
Yeah. It premiered last year at Sundance in Sundance 2018, and then we had a really nice festival run with it, and then Oscilloscope picked it up, and I was very pleased about that. So now we're in a very pleasant relationship with that company.
They are a great company.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they're the curatorial mind of those guys is very much in line with what I think Hal Ashby would have wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so the DVD just came out. And it's really beautifully packaged, and there's
it really is.
Yeah, I was like shocked to see, you know, rarely do you expect, and sort of as in the film, rarely do you expect the marketing to jive with what you actually
right?
like, made, like something that you didn't like design by, you know, committee, and it just sort of came to me in my inbox, and I was like, are you kidding me? This is beautiful. So.
Yeah, and yeah. I got to give you some dap for doing a commentary on a documentary. I don't think I'd seen one in a music documentary, director or film related documentary. So I didn't get to watch the whole thing, but yeah, that was pretty awesome.
Oh yeah, I mean, I hope I never have to hear that. I was just
record it, and it's there for posterity.
It's there for my grandchildren. But yeah, you know, the film was made by like not just me. There was a lot of people involved, and so we wanted to get in a room together.
It was chill. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I'll recall our own experiences, so it worked out. There's a lot of wine involved.
That's the way to do a commentary. Yeah. And there are a couple of people with you, you mentioned, right?
My producers, Brian Morrow and Jonathan Lynch and Christine Beebe and Lisa Jansen, who's like, her stories might have been my favorite, actually. Mm-hmm. Lisa was drinking tequila, and she was like our main archivist.
Better.
So, yeah, so she no, but she is an archivist, so she, you know, she's a very encyclopedic, referential mind of 70s, you know, pop culture and whatnot. So her take is always fascinating.
That's awesome. Well, you know, with a filmmaker documentary, you can't just say, okay, well, you know, we thought we'd throw in this film, you know, because it's. Of course you did. It's chronological. So, but I really liked the stylistic choices you made because, of course, Hal is not around, unfortunately. We lost him a good while ago. But I think a lot of the spirit of the documentary was that you kind of captured his rebelliousness and just how much he fought the system. And I think doing that with his voice through the typewriter, I thought was really effective. And along the way, you didn't compromise the story. You know, there was a narrative, and you got to see his career progression. So, I was really pleasantly surprised, even though I knew you was talking to you. But I always worry that I'll dislike these films before we talk to somebody.
No.
But I really like this one, and I've seen a lot of filmmaker documentaries, and it was really strong. And my wife liked it, too, and she doesn't like Hal Ashby.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's great. Well, that's great. Fantastic. That's great.
She'll have to go through the filmography again and just, you know, reassess maybe. Yeah,
I told her, hey, the last detail, we need to give it a shot. And she's just like, no, one day.
I'm curious, what does she dislike about Harold and Maude? Not to put your wife on blast, but what does she dislike about that film?
I think it's maybe a little too quirky. I don't know. Yeah, I don't. maybe a little silly. I don't know.
She's seen one too many Wes Anderson films. She's like, I've had enough.
You know,
of this genre.
There is a through line there, I think. So, and she's kind of hot and cold with Wes Anderson. So, but yeah, one day we'll do a podcast with her about Harold and Maude. What do you think, Mark?
I really enjoyed it a lot. I mean, people always, as you know, Aaron and I are Criterion fans. They always joke that we like depressing films, but you know, Ashby's films always uplift me. Even those that kind of have more of a down ending for some of the characters, they kind of end up for other characters. And I felt like this film really captured a nice through line through all the movies as you're, you know, as you're going through, you know, focusing on the 70s especially, but also, you know, what happened in the 80s, what were the external forces on Ashby. You know, I think was really, really telling. And the fact that his daughter's favorite movie is one from the 80s that really is, you know, features a young Angelina Jolie, but you know, it's kind of her character and her relationship with her father. So it really captured a really, you know, great story there with Ashby and a great follow-up to anyone that, like, one of the first things that I listened to as part of getting into film was, I say listen, it's a book, but I listened to it on tape, Pictures at a Revolution. So,
of course,
you know, you know, In the Heat of the Night is in there,
right,
which Hal edited, and it really felt like a nice companion piece to that. So, yeah, kudos.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, it was quite a journey to make it, and the different parts of it came together at different times, and, you know, as you're, like, cobbling together, you know, funding and interviews, and it was just a matter of like, well, I know that I want to cover I wanted to cover the films of the 70s because I felt like those were the most important. You know, we couldn't do an equal career retrospective. There wouldn't have really been a story there, or that would have been like a 4-part series. But the deeper that we got into, you know, who he was, trying to unpack who he was through interviews with, you know, his friends and producers and girlfriends and wives and all that, it was really interesting because there's so much to the man, and he was such a beautiful soul, but he was super, I mean, he was flawed. He made bad decisions, and I felt like that was a part of who he was, and that made his films infinitely more interesting, and that he had this sort of insight into the human condition and that kind of like perception of depth. You know, that he, like, could understand John Voight's character, you know, in that film. And that's why Lee gravitated toward it. But, yeah, in terms of, like, the letters and things, that was so crazy. We had, I think the letters were the only thing that we had for, like, 6 months. And that was the very first thing that Lisa Jansen, our archivist, found. She was like, there's all these letters at the Academy. And they're insane. And I was like, what? So we, like, went down. I can remember this so clearly. I went with her. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever done this, but you go down to the, you know, it's the Academy. It's the Margaret Herrick Library. This is where they have, you know, it's like the door behind the door behind the door. And you have to put on white gloves. And, and you sort of can just sort of carefully look through everything that they have. And there was just a trove of communication between him and, you know, as you see in the film, you know, various a lot with Norman Jewison, but also like various producers, and then their responses too. So it was always like it was kind of brilliant that was the first thing that we had, you know, besides like this knowledge of the films, you know, that it sort of, you know, live with you, you know, from the moment you see them for years and years. Aside from that, it was like, okay, well, I know we have a letter. So like, how are we going to, these letters are going to steer, they will steer this thing. And they did, ultimately. I felt like they told the story. He got to tell his own story. And then when we actually discovered, you know, his voice, like the audio of him telling, like, you know, why do we make a film, you know, I can't, I'm losing my train of thought, but there was so many great quotes that when we finally found his voice, it was so chilling because we had cut the film and it played fine without it. It just wasn't you know, it wasn't quite there yet. It was like missing this big thing, but all the scenes were sort of in place, and we were actually working toward the same points. Like, for example, when he's talking about his values and how Norman Jewison, when they were editing In the Heat of the Night, really gave him the freedom, you know, to experiment and do what he thought was right. You know, we had sort of tailored this scene without that audio. And then when we found it, it was like, oh, Jesus Christ. All right, this is great. Like, we're doing the right thing. You know, I just, it's really hard to get validation from a person that's like no longer here. So, yeah, it's hard. You know, it was like having him consult from on high.
and I think you're an editor at heart, right? I'm guessing this about you. But is that kind of what brought you to Hal, or did you have a previous appreciation of his films?
Oh yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I've loved his films forever. Since, you know, I like high school and freshman year of college, I think, is when I was really like heavily indoctrinated into the world of Hal Ashby, and that, you know, like, it's, you sort of put yourself in at the, when you're like a freshman in college, it's like the Holden Caulfield and you know, the Harold yeah, I mean, those are the sort of the two, like, oh, I identify with this kind of a person, and these are the, you know, this is what I prefer to listen to and dress like and things like that. So I think that his film sort of defined somewhat of like who I was, what I identified with. Later, when I started editing, you know, with actual seriousness, and then remembered that he was an editor, it was pretty fascinating. So then I could go back and look at his films, you know, that he cut, because I didn't realize for a long time, I didn't realize that he had cut, you know, like Thomas Crown Affair and The Russians Are Coming and all those early.
And the Wilers too.
And the Wilers. Yeah, totally.
I didn't know. So, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. So yeah, that was really something that I was like, I have to like get to know this person, in order to better understand myself, the personality type that, you know, does this kind of thing for a living.
What was kind of the impetus to dig into Hal? I mean, he was obviously in your background, Amy. Was there something that happened or something that really brought you to him as a subject matter? That was like the turning point where you said, you know, I'm going to make a documentary about Hal.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was pretty pregnant, and I'd read Nick Dawson's book about Hal Ashby, which is a really well written book, and it just kind of stuck with me. I couldn't believe that I thought the film had been made. I thought there was already a documentary, and I just needed to go rent it from Netflix after I read
felt the same way. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I must have missed that. So let me go Google this. And I was like, huh, that's weird. Let me try this again. Maybe it's on Hulu. And I was like, what the? Okay. It's not. how in the world is this possible? And then it just became like this criminal act. There wasn't a film about him. And I felt probably somewhat like a zealot in terms of like, this has got to happen and I'm going to be the one to do it. I don't know. I mean, I tend to get that way about things that I like, really like make my mind up about, like, we're going to do this. He started to feel like a relative of mine in a strange way. And I was having dreams about the man and really bonded with early on with a few people in his life. I bonded with Griff and with Lee and with the man that sort of runs his estate. And it seemed like something like, you know, just like I had to do it. So compelled.
He did have that, and you kind of captured this in the film, but it seems like he was so likable and he had gave off such positive energy. I love the piece about how it was working with actors. Now, if you were a studio head, maybe get a different side of him. And by the way, the letters certainly punctuated that aspect of Hal's personality, the warmth and the fiery rebellion. The F them was...
Oh, it's so great. So great. Like the all caps was like, my God.
Reading that had to be just a pleasure. And I'm sure there's a lot more...
I was going to say, just to be clear about that, we that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there was so much correspondence, pages upon pages, that I was, it was, it was exciting. It was funny to read. And then it got really depressing because I was like, oh no, Hal, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, like, pull back, don't do that. It's like CC'd every studio head, you know, and legal team possible. And it was just like, oh no, you could just see where it all kind of went down in flames.
You can kind of see the reactions, I'm sure, as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think of, like, you know, the American New Wave, and even though he was part of that, I think of him as kind of an outlier. I mean, just, of course, you have your Scorsese's, Coppola's, you had Nashville, Altman, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they're all great filmmakers, but they're a little, this is not a good term, but they're a little bro-y.
they're super bro-y. Yeah, and, you can say that.
Yeah, and Ashby, I think, and now if you really think about it, he had some strong female characters, like, you know, Jane Fonda in Coming Home is extremely strong. I'm thinking Maude, of course.
Well, Maude, yeah, for sure.
Ruth Gordon.
I met her, actually, in Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
Not actual Maude, that would be amazing. But even like The Last Detail, it's very bro-y, and even Coming Home is very bro-y, but there is a subtlety, and I kind of think of, like, I don't know if you're a classic film buff, but, you know, there's the Lubitsch touch. You know, he had a little bit of softness in his films, and he would take on difficult subjects, and I think Hal took on extremely difficult subjects, but there was, you know, Coming Home from a brutal war, you know, dealing with urban renewal and,
racism and gentrification. And yeah, I mean, every film that he tackled had some super heavy theme in it that, you know, could have been handled differently, you know, like perhaps like another, the flip side of Coming Home would be like The Deer Hunter, you know,
right.
Another great,
great
film, but it's in terms of like, that I agree with what you're saying. I even beyond like having strong female characters, I think what seems more striking is that the male protagonists are not uber masculine. Like they're not even The Last Detail, like, which would be probably the height of that. It's not, because they're very, very fragile.
I would say that Nicholson's character was a little strong, but I think there's a character arc there as well. For his most bro-y film, you know, it doesn't match up with, say, Taxi Driver and that sort of masculinity, or The Deer Hunter, or any of Scorsese's earlier work. So,
right,
yeah, he seems more just humanist to me than
definitely
any of those directors. I mean, I know know what I'm in for, and I know that I'm going to enjoy any of his, you know, 70s work especially, and you know, just that I know I'm going to connect with other humans on screen specifically. But there's also, you know, there's the political side of it. It seems like, you know, Vietnam really seems to hover over so many of his films, you know, Harold and Maude, you know, Vietnam and the military, with Harold and Maude, the uncle and mother trying to send him into the military, and of course The Last Detail, and, you know, Coming Home. But he's also just so subtly funny, whether it's a dark comedy, a lot of it's dark comedy, but you know, I'm always enjoying not just you know, it, like I said before, it's not just a dark film, it's always something that's interesting. You know, I laughed out loud when Carrie Fisher on screen in Shampoo was Lorna.
She's great. She is great. Yeah.
So yeah, it's I definitely really enjoyed, you know, digging into these films and really comparing him to his you know, his contemporaries. I'd only seen, up until recently, I'd only seen The Last Detail and Harold and Maude, and we rewatched Harold and Maude with my family, and it really, really struck home. I felt like I was taking a chance. I mean, it's an early 70s movie to show, you know, teenagers. I have, 13 and a 15-year-old. My daughter turned to me and, you know, almost three quarters of the way through and was like, yeah, this is one of my favorite movies. And I'm like, yes, score.
Indoctrinated.
Yeah, and she asked, you know, recently, do you have anything else that's like Harold? I think it was the, you know, the music, as well as the She really identified with Harold because there's these as teenagers, you know, she stated this, that they'll just be like, if they're in the middle of exam week or a difficult week, they'll just be like, I just want to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And they'll say it offhandedly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's at least a little bit of, I don't want to say truth, but, you know, they're really expressing themselves in that way. And this was really a physical way to portray that on screen. And I, you know, we all had the biggest laugh out loud, I think, with the pool reveal.
Completely. Brilliant. That's one of my favorite scenes, like, in film history, period. That, and the music, the piano, it's like so mellow. I mean, I think what you're saying is totally true. It's like, it demystifies like dark emotional turmoil, you know, and these sort of suicidal thoughts, mm-hmm. and then sort of like, oh, okay, we're not alone, you know. And then you sort of, you know, as the, not to spoil, I don't want to spoil for people who haven't seen it, but then it gets real. Then it gets like, So then when, you know, when Maude actually, you know, really does have something real happen to her, it's like, oh, it's just, you're gutted, you know, because, but you've been looking at like super, like graphic, gory Harold's like fantasizing of suicide fantasy the entire, you know, for an hour and a half. But then it's just so powerful. And I think that, and it's just his like the emotionality of that soundtrack. You should have your daughters seen The Graduate yet? I mean, that is
That's another.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
I remember the first time I saw that in high school and was blown away. I was like, oh my God, this is a movie. You know what we're talking. Like, this is great.
And like you said, I think the, you know, the music for sure is a through line. I mean, she's now introduced to Cat Stevens and that would introduce her to Simon and Garfunkel. But I think, you know, with Harold and Maude too, I liked the, there's a really subtle shot. And I was thinking of the, you know, talking about Vietnam and the military, but there's just a subtle shot of her that shows that she was a Holocaust survivor. So that
You know,
gave me a moment too that I could, you know, I let it go and then rewound it and just showed it again, be like, just to make sure that it settled in and like, yeah, they got it. You know, so it really just gives you a sense towards the end there of where she's coming from.
It puts everything in perspective. I love that he stayed. He's only on that shot for like 2 seconds. Like you do have to, really you got to freeze. You have to be really paying attention. And that is so Ashby. It's not like so many filmmakers have handled that completely differently. Mm-hmm. We've been like long pullback, you know, like reveal on the arm.
The score. Like,
It was swelled, but it's like, no, like,
there.
Oh my God. Okay. It's such a real moment. And the sun is setting and they're arm in arms. Like, puts her entire, you know, who she is, all of a sudden makes complete sense. You're like, okay, right. Yeah, vitality. Got
yes.
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very important.
And just the subject matter, too. I just think that kind of speaks to Hal's daring. And you, I think, captured this in the film very well, that he would go for a 20-year-old, 80-year-old, I guess you'd call it a friendship, relationship friendship. I can see why the studio
fell
heads
in love, so.
The studio heads it does that the synopsis doesn't read as well as it plays.
I think, you know, it's interesting times. You could get away with a lot more in the 70s.
You could
than you can right. now. Like, so
that
crazy.
Would never make it to see the
can
light
you
of day
imagine
today.
Oh no,
not even Netflix.
No, not even Netflix.
I mean, it was I forget who was talking about it in the documentary, but they mentioned how in the 70s, you know, directors could just make their movie, and it was really up to them to, if it made money, then they would continue to make movies. And if it didn't, well, then, you know, they might be out of luck. But, you know, that seemed to, you know, really inform how things changed for Hal in the 80s with the, you know, just the media conglomerates. And he couldn't necessarily seem to make the movie that he wanted to.
It just seemed like it became and, you know, it was I don't think it's any one thing. I don't think it's completely the studio's fault. I don't think it was Hal's fault. I think it was a little bit of everything, much like everything in life. It's like, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, depending on who's telling the story. But, you know, I mean, we saw enough of the correspondence and talked to enough people involved that that I know that the studios were coming down hard on him, and I know they treated him unfairly, and I know that things got super duper corporate. At that same time, Hal was just like, okay, fuck this. Mm-hmm. Like, I know how to make films. Just get, let me do it. You know, it's like, but most of those guys, like, went at that time, started getting, like, I mean, I'm fairly certain that Altman just, like, didn't he move to Europe and started getting, like, European money? Like, he, so many of the, I guess Scorsese has persevered through all that. But
yeah, well, yeah, I think the 80s were kind of a checkered decade for all of them. I mean, Altman still worked, as you mentioned, but he didn't have, you know, the 70s and the 90s. I think if you, I'm sure maybe the late 80s, he was starting to come back around and, yeah, he worked. He, you know, made plenty of movies, but yeah, that's, I think, what really, you know, to put Hal's peak in a bucket, it really does fit within these two digits, the '70s, you know, and then and then the dividing line after being there, and the '80s, he fell off a cliff, and I think to your point that I think also his technique didn't really evolve with the way the film production was going, so. And you captured this in the documentary that he would get a lot of coverage, and I think for small films like that, they wanted you to operate lean. And I think the people that did find success in the '80s, and remember, there was an indie movement in the late '80s, so there was kind of a void there. I don't know if there was space for him. And then it's really just too bad, because I think some of the stuff he came up out with in the '80s, you know, could have been the caliber of his '70s work if he had been handled a little better. And I say that, you know, not just by the studios, but by himself. And, you know,
there's no compromise, it seems like, which, you know, you do have to compromise. It's like a marriage, right? Making
right. A right.
Yeah. You do have to compromise some.
But I mean, yeah, and though in a marriage, though, it's like you find out your spouse has been like cheating on you or something. Like, you know, it's like they weren't exactly the ideal spouse. So
yeah.
I can understand, like, he's like, they're taking the films away from him and, you know, not letting him edit or not letting him do the things that, you know, that's what he does best. And
that's
so
it's like neutering it's got him, to have, really.
Completely. I mean, you're powerless. And then, like, at that point, like, what's the point? You know, I mean, he's the guy that he had his way of shooting and to get the gold. And I mean, Jeff Bridges had like that crazy, that, like, Jeff Bridges line about the guy, look at the pudding that comes out of this guy's oven.
Yeah.
That, like, when he said that,
that was a great line.
Oh my God, yes. Like, if there was like a log line, like, here we go.
And I know we're talking about the film a lot, so I just, to the listeners, I just highly recommend you watch the film. The good thing is you do cover the films in chronological order. But, mm-hmm. you know, you capture them through the essence of Hal. So even though there's discussion of the films and how I think it's how Hal's voice shaped the films or vice versa. But there's not a lot of deep analysis either. I mean, it's not like you're going into the themes of Shampoo. Well, maybe a little bit. Shampoo, maybe
A little bit. I think we try to touch on the narcissism of the culture. But I mean, look, I did have the cut that was like way longer.
Did you have the 5-hour cut?
I was like, just let me have my like film theory degree cut. Like, let me get to have this for myself. And then everyone's like, okay, now that we've done that, can we please like make a film out of it? Hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, you
can we see the 4-hour cut or?
No, I don't own it anymore.
Oh,
none
that's
of that
right.
Footage is mine.
We'll have to call our friends at Oscilloscope and see.
Yeah.
See if they'll hook us up.
Yeah, we're both Circle of Trust members, which means that we get every Blu-ray that they come out with. So, you know, maybe we have some pull.
We have a lot of listeners that have partaken in the Circle of Trust. They're very proud on their social medias, and so we have a lot of listeners that already have your disc. So, go watch it.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, did you plan this that way, Aaron? Because like the disc came out within like a month of when we were going to be talking to Amy. So I don't know. I think you had some kind of sixth sense.
As a matter of fact, I did. Okay. I guess we spoke, what, 6 months ago, Amy?
Yeah, I think that was a fair amount of planning.
Yeah, a little bit of planning.
Yeah.
Do you want to dive a little bit into his work or a little more? Well, I think it's worth pointing out that The Landlord was just released on Blu-ray, and I don't know if it was previously available anywhere. I think probably overseas.
It's not. Yeah, I checked that. It's Kino's it. So thank you, Kino.
And I'm sure you got a print of it prior to this. Obviously, you saw it before when you made the movie.
Oh, yeah.
You cut it up a little bit. But I thought that was very, very... And again, the Ashby touch. So he took... Well, urban renewal in Park Slope. So a landlord buys property in Park Slope and gets a little grief about it. And here I'm thinking, guy's a little rich now. If you've ever been to Brooklyn Park Slope, you'll know what I mean. But... I think he tackles that, you know, very sensitive topic, and I would say that in the 60s, even though it was covered, you know, like Guess Who's Coming Home for Dinner, mm-hmm. and a lot of the Poitier films, I mean, they did cover race relations, but in hindsight, they don't always, it can seem a little ham-fisted. Mm-hmm. I thought with The Landlord, I was actually very impressed that the subtlety, and I could see how, you know, if it came out today, they might say, well, there's a little bit of white savior going on here. But kind of it was actually, you know, he was almost assimilated into that culture a little bit. And I thought that was a little mature, a little beyond its years. And I think it wasn't received well. I don't remember.
Mm. Yeah, I think
maybe
it was,
in retrospect.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a flop, or at least it didn't, you know, come out with a huge bang. But like, just pause for a second. Like, what an insane film to be your directorial debut.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The way that he cut, like, the first 5 minutes, he's like the intercutting between, you know, the streets of, they shot in Bedford-Stuyvesant. So it's like this, like just gnarly streets of New York at a different time. And then cross cutting with this all white, mm-hmm. Indoor, what's it called? Where they're playing handball again.
Racquetball.
Bougie sport, racquetball. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like white guy, you know. And so that the crazy experimental editing, and then that sort of begins the journey like that. It's like, wow, okay, that was pretty bold.
Yeah, and he portrays both of those worlds a little bit over the top, not quite stereotypical, maybe on the white side a little more stereotypical. Mm-hmm. And a little more heavy-handed. I think the dinner party scene was, but
so uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable
very
to watch
much
it
so.
Now.
Yeah, yeah. In a way, but also, interesting. And of course, Beau Bridges fleeing from his tenants, I guess, and all their
very
friends. That was pretty interesting. Did you get to see it yet, Mark?
I did. Yeah, Well, I think just because of library, I saw Coming Home first and then just went chronologically with this. And one of my favorite parts was were the quick fantasy shots, which
yes.
Lee Grant. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if he ever used those again either. I don't remember them in his other films. They really give a great view into the mind of the characters and their prejudices. And, you know, sometimes it's just a quick one, like, you know, with the mother in white with the parasol and the eight children surrounding her, you know, as she points to Rebelli and says Excedrin headache number one. It's just a quick, you know, it's like 5 seconds, but it's really great.
Yeah, when I interviewed Lee Grant, we talked a lot about those scenes, and she was saying how she was like, I feel very uncomfortable saying these lines, like, oh my God, you know, and this woman had like come back from the blacklist, like she had fought like really big things, and she was like reading this going, oh my Lord, I don't know if I can do this, and Hal was like, you can do it, and then decided that he would get on a boat, I think, like out in he was directing from a ferry on the river far away from her so they could shoot, you know, with a long lens, and he's out of her purview so she could feel sort of alone, and then they got the shot, but she said he was like yelling from the, like, come on, Lee, like, you can do it.
Academy Award winner Lee Grant.
I know.
Well, he worked on a lot of those actually. Got a few trophies for people.
Yep.
Yeah,
she came
sure
back
did.
For Shampoo, you know.
Yeah, actually, that's where she won, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah,
and she wore her wedding dress to the like a 20s wedding dress to the Academy Awards. That's so cool.
And if there's such a thing as a mainstream Hal Ashby film, I'm guessing Shampoo's probably it. Would you say that's the closest to? I mean, it's almost screwball comedy, and
I think so. I think it's its most popular. Other than Harold and Maude is like a cult classic, but I think Shampoo is an accessible film.
Yeah.
Although it's like plot-wise, it's kind of all over the place.
And it is political too. It's yeah.
It is.
You kind of forget about how in the times. And I guess he did like to shoot about periods that had just happened. So you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, it's such a sexy film. It is. Taken
aback
by that.
Oh my gosh, the style.
Yeah,
that backless, Julie Christie's backless dress.
Yeah,
one of the most amazing shots I've ever seen. So great.
And of course, Being There was, I'd say, probably his second most popular. Although I think it and Ashby, I think, have probably the biggest cult following now. And do you have a favorite, Amy?
I do not have a favorite. No, I mean, I think I've seen all these films a whole lot of times with a different lens on each time, like looking for different things and combing over different things. So sort of like I kind of feel the same way about the Beach Boys record Pet Sounds. Like I've heard it enough for this lifetime. Like I love, you know, that's like I love that record so much and know it inside and out. And yet like, it's sort of like Harold and Maude, like it's a favorite, sure. But you know, there's a lot of films in the world.
There are, yeah. So I guess you can move on and maybe do another documentary about other filmmakers or musicians. I just finally caught Coming Home the other day, and again, you'd mentioned the masculinity aspect, and actually, I would say that's almost reverse masculinity. You know, he kind of if you just look at the credits, you would probably think, okay, John Voight's probably the buff masculine guy, and Bruce Dern is probably going to be the weenie captain, and that's sort of, you know, I guess physically that's the case, but the way they're portrayed, it's almost the opposite. So Dern kind of is that jingoistic loyal soldier, and he's aggressive, and Voight is passive and actually very sensitive, and so I think that's the Ashby touch. I don't know if that exists or if we just coined that, but I'm going with it.
That's a beautiful, beautiful film. Actually, to just completely contradict everything I just said, I think if I was like forced to pick one, that Coming Home is just it's just a gorgeous film.
It's really special.
It's such a beautiful, beautiful story. It's so, and knowing everything that I know about it now, and just there was a whole backstory that we didn't have time to include in the film, and it was such a crime that we couldn't. It would have derailed the flow of the cut, but I mean, all of the work that went into even getting it into Hal Ashby's hands was like years and years of development through different producers and writers, and Jane Fonda was championing it the whole time, and it was just so admirable, you know, to have her really see this thing through and get it to Jerry Hellman, and then it got it to Hal, and then, you know, everything that Hal did to make it work, and then not having a script and having a heart attack. Like, it's just insane.
Yeah.
So this it
and
probably was
chaos,
conceived during the war then, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I think the name of the book was called Buffalo Soldiers.
Hmm.
It's written by this lady, Nancy Dowd. And and then, you know, Bob Jones did a fair amount of writing on it as well. And definitely. It was like a really, I started reading that book. It's different. You know, it's not Coming Home, which, you know, it shouldn't be. But the impetus is there. You can see how they were like, oh, okay, we can make a film out of this. And I think everything that Jane Fonda was doing at the time, you know, with her activism was so important. And she had to make a film like that. Well, I mean, her and Haskell Wexler.
Oh, for sure.
Just done like medium cool, and was so involved with all of that, you know, the anti-war movement and protesting and getting arrested. So this film, you can just tell, it just breathes like this authenticity and a plea to the country, like humanity, you know, like look at what happens, you know, look at this.
And that final scene, and you did show a bit of it in the in your film, but the final scene is just so powerful. And I actually had watched your film before. I technically had rewatched Coming Home. But you know, many years later, so it made a lot more impact on me now. But it's still is. It's just a very, very powerful scene. I, it's almost unbelievable the circumstances in which it was. I guess it,
I know.
It wasn't scripted. It was just him off the cuff. Now I don't think they would be
funny.
Friends today.
That's... Oh my gosh! Yeah, you know what though? I thought that when we interviewed Voight, I was so freaked out by, you know, his current politics, and I thought, oh, how can he? I just had a lot of preconceptions going into the interview, and, you know, made sure, like, the crew, like, nobody say anything about, you know, whatever, the mm-hmm. Palestine or any, you know, like, I don't want to hear it. And we had to be really buttoned up. He was one of the nicest, like, most giving, thoughtful individuals that we filmed, which, to be honest, really, really took me by surprise and kind of shattered a lot of my illusions and preconceptions about, you know, reaching across the aisle, because I couldn't have found a person more ideologically different than myself. But there he was, and we were like getting emotional together, and he just wanted to talk about his buddy, mm-hmm. And none of that entered in. I mean, that said, I wonder how he does feel about these films and how he sort of reconciles them.
That was
now
the very thing I was thinking. You know, it's being anti-war and also Midnight Cowboy too. I think,
oh man, yeah,
the character he played there, which, and he was a tremendous actor in the 70s, but I don't begrudge him for his beliefs. I think I respect anybody with differing opinions as long as they can back them up, but I think you're right, it's tough to reconcile.
It's a head scratcher, for
it
sure.
It is a head scratcher, you know? But he's amazing. It's
he's so great.
Yeah, he was a good actor.
Well deserved Oscar, mm-hmm. in that film. You know, it's he and Jane
and
Fonda both. You know, just so naturalistic in that movie. It was really, they're just really magnetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was shot naturalistically. I feel like Haskell just nailed. He shot like a beautiful mm-hmm. documentary. It was like the lighting was always so gorgeous and minimal and. Yeah, it's a really beautiful film. And that Tim Buckley song.
We kind of skipped. Yeah, we skipped Bound for Glory, but speaking of Wexler, I think that's his crowning achievement. I mean, as far as Ashby films, Wexler's done quite a bit. But that's the one that I think that's the most showy. I mean, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but the one that you really notice the cinematography being standing out, whereas Coming Home, it's amazing, and as you mentioned, every shot is very well lit and beautiful. That you get carried into carried away with the plot, and you kind of stop noticing. But yeah, Wexler was the master, and then being there is I'd say that's my favorite. Do you have a favorite, Mark?
It's tough because I really need to rewatch The Last Detail. I've only seen it once.
That's one of my, okay.
It's probably that one if I was going to get to rewatch it, but it would be that or Harold and Maude. And I do still need to see Being There and finish Bound for Glory, but yeah, I'd probably go Last Detail. Push come to shove.
Yeah, and you know, speaking of aggression in film, I would say the most aggressive scene in The Last Detail, which you showed a little bit in your film, Amy,
mm-hmm.
in the bar, aggression. But the aggression had a purpose. It was to protect somebody and to kind of stand up for somebody that was maligned.
Yeah,
so,
he was standing up for his values. You know, it was great. That aggression has a good purpose in my book. So,
and that sort of tension worked so great in the film. And Jack, you know, he was hammy and he made it work. So was between the two. Being There, is that one of your favorites, Amy?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what to say about the film. It's a perfect film. I think it's like a genius, perfect film. I think every part of that film is like pretty astounding. It's shot beautifully. Caleb did an amazing job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Peter Sellers is phenomenal. You can tell that Peter Sellers and Hal must have been really tight, as I heard that they were like super, super in sync. And, it comes across. The writing is brilliant. Bob Jones is, mm-hmm. Is, you know, taking Kaczynski's novel and interpreting it in that way and really giving life to Chauncey Gardner's character is interesting. I mean, I've always loved that film. It has particular resonance in now in since like the 2016 election. Yeah. Like it's an obvious like, oh boy, like here we have Bizarro, you know, bad Chauncey, at the, you know, watching TV all day and just sort of speaking, you know, bizarre. It's like a meditation on celebrity culture and how celebrity, you know, the idea of that is actually super, super duper dangerous. So yeah, it's different. I think that film, I think every single one of his films, at least the 70s films, will always be relevant. They mm-hmm. will, as long as we're all, you know, wrapped up in this mortal coil together and just continue to recycle the same issues, decade after decade. I think that he will always be relevant because he's always chosen to make films about themes that we just cannot as a society get. We can't make peace with these things. We just have an inherent hard time.
Being there was sort of a reaction to Nixon, I believe, and I could be mistaken, but yeah, it plays well today. But I guess in the context of the time, it was a little bit influenced by the war as well.
It definitely was. I mean, I know Jerzy Kaczynski, you know, he was a Holocaust survivor. And so I think a lot of the original intent was just saying it was much darker. Mm. And it was like, you know, like here's a view of an alternate view of like some aspects of how fascism can sort of start to bubble up in different ways. And it's sort of this, you know, having this like you know, I hate to say shadow government because that's really sounds like I'm wearing a tinfoil hat right now. But
yeah, InfoWars.
It's like the people that are pulling the strings behind the giant house up on the hill, which they are, you know, and the corporate guys that are controlling a lot of the decisions and the policy that are being made, and sort of like, you know, in that final scene where they're like mm-hmm. wheeling, you know, carrying his body up,
yeah,
yeah, you know, at the guy's funeral, and they're like picking the next president. It's like Bohemian Grove or something. It's truly bizarre. Like, oh, that's such an interesting take on how those decisions are made in such high places of power. But it's scary and it's really funny and super entertaining. And really beautiful film.
And super quotable as well. And I think I love Sellers. I love just about everything he's done, even the Pink Panther. What was that that politically incorrect film he did? Was it What's Up, Doc? Was that it? He did voiceover for a Japanese film.
Oh, sounds familiar.
I couldn't be mistaken, but I think this is my favorite performance of his because it seems like it's the most earnest, the most grounded, and you truly believe that this man has no concept of where he's at. Basically, I mean, he's just confounded and completely innocent and pleasant too. So So it has that little that levity in this complex world where. Where people are being, strung around as the shadow, the puppets, puppeteers are orchestrating their move, and they're just going right along with it and enjoying the ride. So yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. The footage that you used in the documentary was really stood out. I'm assuming it was the new restored 4K digital transfer. That's on the Criterion disc. It's just shown.
Yeah. Most definitely. No, my producer Brian Morrow was maniacal about making sure that we had all of the best fidelity. Obviously mm-hmm. it's like a film about a filmmaker, so you want to have the best stuff. But even like some of the older to your point, that footage, I mean, those scenes, like they're colored so well. They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
And when we were coloring our film, it was like, oh, don't touch any of, you know, like we're only coloring what we shot.
Right.
Those films are as those films look, exactly how they were meant to look. But even like some of our, you know, like the funeral footage is a little, you know, Warren Beatty and Bud Cort are at Powell's memorial and they're talking about him. And it was like all we had was this really gnarly VHS tape that had been dubbed and redubbed for, you know, over and over again. So I was like trying to get that thing we tried a million different ways. And then finally we just were like, well, let's just lean into it. You know, it's like a piece of archival. Let's project it. You could project it and then shoot it 4K and then kind of like mess with the edges. So that's when we really started to have a lot of fun with that stuff.
And I think you're referencing what I think is Bud Cort getting the best line in the film, which I won't quote, let people watch.
Right?
But yeah, I didn't think, okay, wow, oh, this is some crappy blue VHS print. Yeah, it just, it fit perfectly. And yeah, great line.
His comic timing is just so, yeah, I mean, he's so great. Yeah, we were pretty bummed. We weren't able to get Bud in the film, but I was like, we're going to get him in the film some way. So
right. There you go.
There we go. Yeah. Save that line.
He was in your film and an Arrested Development joke, but.
Yeah. Well, shall we move a little bit into Hal's legacy and kind of, it's probably the last thing that we'll get into, just, you know, what he means to, I mean, what he means to you, Amy, what he means to you, Aaron and I, and, you know, what that kind of means for filmmaking in the future. And I think I'll give it to you, Amy, you really alluded to it as to how we can't seem to get out of our own way as a race. And so his films will remain timeless and in the 70s. You know, maybe talk a little bit more about what you think his legacy will be on a film watching audience. Maybe, you know, my kids as they get older, you know, what's really going to resonate them with them as they, you know, continue to watch his movies.
I think what is going to resonate, I mean, is essentially what I said. I think the themes are constantly going to be relevant and timely. I think his creative approach was very unique and very cool. And that will always be, you know, what they call evergreen. Like, I think it's always something that you go, oh, damn, that was beautiful. Like that crazy wide shot with the cue that just drops in at the right time. And then you pull back, like there's a way that, you know, and he has been homaged to, to, for lack of a better word, a lot, and by filmmakers that I also admire, but it's very easy to go, oh, that was like a quintessential Ashby, you know, scene right there. I think for me personally, what he gave me and what he will continue to give me is that he is now the sort of cinematic, like, lighthouse, in terms of things that I want to make and contribute to the world. And I want those things to be not frivolous. I want them to be not ironic. I want them to be authentic and genuine and to have a point that, like, you know, is not trendy, but it's like having a bigger stake in the game and looking at issues and appreciating things and that are, you know, with a greater depth, but also just having like a very human touch in the approach to work. So like moving forward, I'm like developing projects for myself. And I mean, I do, this is so corny, but like, I would be like, well, what would Hal do? You know, like need it tattooed on my arm or something, like, and I, you know, sure. Like I do. And I thought about that frequently when I was editing the film. I was like, well, what would he do in this? Okay. He'd cut the scene. He would take that scene out, or like, no, he'd give it some air because he didn't rush things. So I think there is an approach that can be gleaned from, like his the pathology in his films and how the films were made and how humans interact with one another. They're very real, and they're very real stories about underdogs, and, you know, eccentric people that are marginalized. And I find all those stories to be the best stories. So that's what I personally will continue to take with me. But I think that's why a lot of people identify with him and his films is for those reasons.
Yeah, that's great. Any takeaways, Aaron?
Well, that was beautiful. It's hard to top that. But I'll just say that I think when I think of eccentricity, I can't get the word out. He was eccentric, and he also was. I think he was an underdog himself. I think he, and I've read a little bit about him. You mentioned Down and Dirty Pictures. But there have been other things, and he kind of did kind of stumble into a lot of great projects and had this great run accidentally on purpose a little bit. So he was at the time seen, you know, not really seen as the big dog. But I think today he's become one of the more influential filmmakers from that era. You know, and again, we're talking about going up against, Scorsese, Spielberg. Why can't I name 70s filmmakers?
Coppola. Coppola, yeah. I talk about this a lot with my dork friends when we sit around. We talk about new wave cinema of the 70s. But do you consider John Cassavetes in that camp as well?
I think he's a little outside that camp. He was his own.
I would agree.
No, Ashby might have been influenced by him a little bit, I think.
I feel like those guys, Cassavetes is a little farther off the bell curve in terms of like, okay, he really got out there. Monty Hellman as well.
I think the Ashby cloth a little bit.
Right? No, that's where my, like, that's the target zone for me. And I think it's that pure naturalism. That's just like, oh, okay. So it's so hard to find that. It's starting to come back around again, though. I do see it in films now where I'm like, oh, that was like, gosh, what was that film? Lady Bird. There was moments in that where I was like, oh my God, this is good. It's like watching a 70s film. It's fantastic. Like an Elaine May movie or something.
Yeah. Right. And as you mentioned, kind of, you know, knowing when to sit with the characters and let the moment happen and when to keep it flowing along. I think there's that balance. Now, I think Hal mastered that balance. He made films entertaining and impactful. And as you mentioned, as you put it, human. Well-rounded. He had his agendas. We it's no secret where he wanted. He was not a fan of the Vietnam War, for one.
Right.
Or urban renewal, but he does. You know, he covers it with. I was going to say subtlety. Maybe not so much with the landlord, as far as that topic. But
no.
But where can people see the movie, Amy? I know it's out on Oscilloscope, but.
Oh, yeah. So I think it's still on iTunes and Amazon Prime and Hulu. If you go to Oscilloscope's web, I should like have this memorized. Let me see. I think it's at howl.oscilloscope.net or oscilloscope.how, something.
And we'll put the link in the show notes for people to find the website, too.
And it's got, I think everything is listed there. But I mean, most of the major VOD providers have it up right now. I've seen it. My children are like, oh, look, it's on Amazon.
Right. it's available for rental, I think, everywhere. But everyone should buy the Blu-ray.
Buy the Blu-ray, of course, because there's a lot of interviews and, you know, just some scenes with some of those cool people, you know, that are that aren't going to be. I mean, you know, Pablo Ferro's just passed away. And we've lost Haskell. And so it's important, you know, once this generation of Hollywood legends is gone, it's like, oh no, the stories are, you know, gone with it. So it's important to really take these people in.
Yeah. There's another 20 minutes Amy's alluding to on the cutting room floor, which is, you know, just more footage from these great people. So definitely recommended.
And now we have the Hal documentary. It's out there in perpetuity for you. So it'll pop up on the algorithms, as we were talking about before the show.
Oh, fantastic.
You're in the algorithm matrix. But no, great movie. I'm glad you made it. I think you were about to ask.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what's next for you, Amy? What's is there anything you'd like to plug? What's your next project?
Well, I will plug. I will say I was working on a film, a documentary called Other Music, and that just premiered at Tribeca. So that's out in the world right now too, and I'm sure it'll get picked up soon. It's a beautiful film about the closing of a legendary record store, but it's a bigger look at sort of how we experience music. And there's a ton of incredible artists in the film. So I was one of the early editors, and I was like juggling with Hal at the same time and then somehow escaped that, not having a nervous breakdown, but the filmmakers are fantastic. And then I kind of helped him sort of, I think I'm listed as a co-producer miraculously, but, that was a great film. So that's out now. And then I'm developing like this sort of episodic series about, let's just say it's like very much in line with Hal. It's like taking these moments of history that are slightly unsung and and positioning them in a cool light in 2019. So I feel like that's my wheelhouse. Like, I'm best when I'm like digging through the crates and finding something cool and putting it on and listening or showing and being like, isn't this cool? Check this out. Oh my God, what's the story here? You know? So I think that's what's in my future.
Could you see yourself making another filmmaker or musician or I guess biographical documentary?
Yeah, I mean, if the project is right or the idea is right, of course I would. I'm most interested right now though in getting into like the episodic form because I think there's a lot to be explored there and experimented with. It's an exciting time to kind of build these stories that culminate and have an arc over like 3 or 4 episodes. So I'm like kind of trying to wrap my head around how you would like show run essentially something like that.
Well, but I think first you call Netflix.
Or Hulu. Or there's these like cool people called agents and managers, and you call them first. And
there you go. Yeah, there's a
we
process.
We go from there.
Their people call their people. But you're right. I eventually I think we're gonna do an episode on just Netflix and the way TV and film are kind of blending and. Especially with documentary film, and I think we are in an exciting time. So I can't wait to see what you do next and what next project you land. So thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you. This is a really fun conversation. I don't get to do this very often anymore, so it's nice to like sit down and talk film for an hour.
Awesome. Yeah. Really great to have you, Amy. You're a pleasure to talk to. That was great.
Thanks.
And what about social media? Are you active there?
Not really. Not really. I mean, I'm like active with my like 99-year-old grandmother on Facebook and the Howl movie. There is a Facebook page for that and an Instagram page.
We will not put the 99-year-old grandmother's Facebook in the show notes. No, we got to keep some things private.
I have a Twitter account. I just forgot my login information. I don't think I've logged in for like a year.
Oh no.
So I don't know. There's like. Not too much for me on social media right now, but I'm sure I'll dip back into it at some point.
And you do have a personal website too, and we'll put that in the show notes
as well.
Oh yeah,
I have a website. That's what I do. There's a website.
There you go.
It's like 2000 up in here. I got it.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks, Amy, for joining.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. You can find Criterion Close Up at Criterion CU on Twitter. You can find Criterion Close Up on Facebook, and of course, go to the 25th Frame to find the podcast and all the other podcasts on the network. And thanks for talking with us too, Aaron. I'm Mark Herney.
Thanks. Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Out, single. If you want to be free, because there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to be high, be high. If you want to be low. 'Cause there's a million ways to go. You know that there are.